Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. B-F-F-T. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
My next guest is the foremost expert on recruiting. Nationally, he's the guy. That's why I like having him on the show. He's also normal. I don't like having weirdos on this show. And I mean that with all due respect to the weirdos. But Greg Biggins is a normal person. Every time we have him on, we talk about things that have nothing to do with recruiting, and it kind of reaffirms in my mind that Greg Biggins is a guy you could hang out with at a game. Just talk. Watch the game. Biggins is joining us now. Am I right about that? You're not a weirdo.
No, man. 100% that guy who just sit in a bar, having a cold one, whatever your beverage of choice, and just shooting the breeze. 100%.
Really? Like
I
that.
Appreciate the compliment.
You bet. I mean, you deserve it, man. You have arrived at this point in your life as somebody that I would hang out with. So you get
Dude,
that.
You know what? I've talked to some important people and gotten some compliments, but having you want to hang with me, that's like up there.
Biggins?
That's way up there. I feel
help
like I've
me.
Arrived. I've arrived. I've Nick Saban just offered me a scholarship just now by you wanting to hang with me.
Man, now everybody wants to hang with you all of a sudden. Look, Biggins.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Tell me how did this recruiting day differ because of COVID than maybe other signing days?
Honestly, it wasn't that different, to be honest with you. The whole process was different leading up to this point. You know, no trips and just tough to evaluate, no camps in the summer. No official visits, like I mentioned, no track to, you know, really evaluate that data. So all that made it really tough, I think. But as far as today, it was same old in terms of, you know, we thought 75 to 80% of the guys that are committed would sign, and they did. You had your normal flips. You had, you know, guys that, you know, we thought might wait, go ahead and commit today, and guys we thought would sign decided to wait a little bit. So, I mean, you still have your normal flips and surprises, but in terms of just COVID, like today felt like a normal signing day.
I keep, you know, looking at the Pac-12. Obviously, I'm focused there, but what jumps out at you when I say that? Like, who in the Pac-12 conference had a nice day today?
Yeah. Oh, so, I mean, Oregon, we'll start with them because they're number one right now. I wouldn't say they had a great day because they, how can I preface this correctly? They had a great class, but as far as today, you know, in terms of a team that signed a bunch of guys who weren't already committed, you know, ironically, it's a team that we've talked about a lot. That was actually UCLA. You know, usually they're a team that struggles on signing day. It's kind of almost like a running joke is going back to the Bob Toledo years is they would be have all this momentum and the signing rolls around, they'll get shut out. But they actually were able to flip four or five guys in the last couple of days, and they're still in the running for a few more. So I like what UCLA did. You know, USC getting Jackson Dart, that was a huge pickup because I like Miller Moss a lot. He's been committed for a long time. But to come in and piggyback Miller with Jackson Dart, who, you know, both ASU and UCLA badly wanted, it just kind of shows the power of that USC brand still, because a lot of, you know, players would be scared off of having a top 100 quarterback already committed in that class. But, you know, Dart, who probably elevated his stock more than just about anybody else this year with a great season out of Utah. So USC able to get him, and you know, they were 1 and 2 by a pretty wide gap. No one will catch them. Both those two schools still have some guys they're waiting on, most notably, you know, JT Tumalau, Corey Foreman, Sierra Wright, still looking at both schools. USC could flip Rajon Davis. Also, Oregon trying to get him as well, LSU commit. So I think those two schools have separated. And then you look at Cal, Utah, Washington, ASU, UCLA. All those schools are kind of in that next group.
Greg Biggins is with us. UCLA impressed on the field a little bit this year. Do you feel like the success they had in recruiting had to do with this year, or was that already coming down the pipeline, and what we saw today was just kind of, you know, the momentum that Chip Kelly has in general.
Yeah, no, I think the season did help a little bit, and I've been saying it before. I also think that the staff, maybe the last couple of weeks, actually started to recruit a little harder, right? What a concept. But like you mentioned, they did look a little bit better, had those close losses to Oregon and USC, which could have been wins for them. But they came into today as the number 11 ranked class in the country. In the Pac-12. So the only team I think they were ahead of was Oregon State. They're now seventh. They're probably going to finish fifth by the end of the day. There's a couple guys we're still waiting on. So I think it's always been an easy place to recruit to, but you have to actually try. And as like I said, I think the last week to 2 weeks, the staff really got after it and evaluated some guys, were able to flip a couple players, and focused in on some local guys who you're kind of wondering why they weren't involved early on. So nice job. Again, nice job by them. They were probably the one school in the Pac-12 that probably signed the most new players, guys that weren't already committed to them. So, again, hopefully we'll see. I think the Pac-12 is more fun when you have a competitive USC, UCLA, and then obviously Oregon, Washington. You know, I think it's more fun when you have more good teams in the conference.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. You know, and at USC, do you feel like, you know, Clay Helton looks like he's not in any jeopardy now? Like, I know that has been an ongoing thing, but do you feel like that helped USC in recruiting this year? Has that been a negative for Clay Helton?
Yeah, no, 100%. I think, and the crazy thing is, you look back, and it sounds weird to say, but I don't know if any football team was probably helped more by COVID than USC. They didn't have to play Notre Dame or Alabama this year, two great teams. And even going back to that first game of the year, coming into the season, there was so much, you know, negative talk about Clay Helton, job stability. They were so close to losing that ASU game, and then even just as close to losing that Arizona game. If they lose even one of those games, more or less two, I think, you know, Clay Helton, there's a great chance he's not here right now. So they kind of come back, win those two games. They're 5-0, and they have all this momentum. You talk to kids, and I get that same vibe right now that I did back when Pete Carroll was rolling. Kids are saying, hey, USC's back. And, you know, you kind of want to just say, hey, you know, calm down a little bit, right? You know, it's great to get the wins, but, you know, performance-wise, eyeball test, you know, show me a little bit more before I'm seeing USC's back. But I think right now kids are impressionable, and they see a 5-0 team. The staff was really good in terms of how they recruited. They by far came out and recruited harder this year than they have in a lot of years. They brought a lot of new coaches in, especially on the defensive side of the ball. Everyone knows about Dante Williams, but, you know, Vic Soto and Craig Navarro, the safety coach, all did a great job too. So, you know, I think USC, you know, what could have been disastrous ended up being really, really good. They have a chance. Again, Corey Foreman, my gut is they land him. I think they got a great chance to flip Rajon Davis from LSU, and they're right there for Sierra Wright. So if they land those three guys, looking at the top three or four class. Remember last year we talked, John, they were number 10 in the Pac-12, their worst finish by far in the history of their program. So from 1 year to the next, pretty radical difference.
We're talking to Greg Biggins, 24/7 Sports National Recruiting Analyst. Biggins, Mario Cristobal looks like he's going to get a contract extension from Oregon. How much does that factor in recruiting? Because Cristobal brought it up earlier this week. He said that, you know, sometimes that will be used in a narrative, you know, Auburn with this and that. I do think Cristobal is committed to Oregon. I think this deal gets done. But how is that used in recruiting negatively when a guy's future becomes a little bit in doubt?
Yeah, no, every school in the Pac-12 that was recruiting against Oregon for some of these guys that were already signed was using that. You know, basically, hey, you don't want to go to Oregon. You know, Coach Cristobal, Mario Cristobal, he's going to Auburn. It's a done deal. Contract's already – I'm now hearing some of the funniest things. Contract's already done. Paperwork's dry. They're waiting to announce it later. So, obviously, he's probably the most involved head coach in terms of recruiting that I know of. I mean, he is personally involved in every single kid, and that's how Oregon recruits. They recruit by committee. So, if they lose Mario, that's a huge blow for them, because even though they've lost some assistants, he's all, you know, he's been the guy. He's been the stable one that's always still there. So I think as long as he's there, they're always going to recruit really, really, really well, because I mean, he demands that you have to be relentless. It's not, you know, you recruit, you know, one day and take a couple days off. But you're recruiting every day, all day long. And I think once he signs the extension, and I believe it or not, I actually had different coaches tell me like 2-3 years ago that they thought that, you know, that was a dream destination with the Auburn job. I don't know what the connection was, but they just said, hey, watching that Auburn job opens up, Mario's going to take it, even more than Miami. They thought Auburn. Again, I don't know why, but that's just what I was told. So if he says no to Auburn and he's able to go to kids and say, look, I said no to Miami, I said no to Auburn, I'm not going anywhere, I got my extension, you know, let's go. I think that's going to do a ton. They're already recruiting at a high level, and the 2022 class is already looking, you know, really good. But I definitely think having him sign an extension and turn down Auburn is nothing but good for the program.
Nationally, as I interview coaches, some coaches, if I say to them, hey, I can give you a five-star or four-star guy at any position, there are some guys who will say, I'll take a quarterback or I'll take a running back. A lot of others say defensive tackles or offensive left tackle. What is that position that you believe or you see most coveted by coaches?
I think quarterback. And I mean, it's the position that, you know, that guy has to be not just competent. We're seeing that you can't win without a really, really good quarterback. You look at the four playoff teams, the common denominator. You need offensive line play. You need great defense. You need great coaching. But you have to have a quarterback that can make plays. The game's changed, right? We talked about Alabama today earlier on one of our shows and just how differently. Remember back in the day, you know, Auburn was a grinded out team. Get a bunch of big, angry O-linemen, some great running backs, and just pound you. Now Alabama plays, you know, flashy football. It's all about flash plays. You need these big chunk plays. It's hard to go down the field at these little 3-4 yards in a cloud of dust. So you need to have a quarterback that can't just be a game manager. He's got to be able to make plays and make plays down the field. So a quarterback is always going to be your guy. And then after that, I think there's, you know, maybe a left tackle, a corner, and a D tackle. I think those three positions are so hard to find. Quality corners. And again, we do our rankings based on the NFL draft. So, you know, look at how highly you see a quality corner, an offensive tackle, and a defensive tackle. Obviously, quarterback goes one, so that's why we place a premium on that. But I think those four spots, man, you can lock down the field with a great corner. You can protect your quarterback with a great left tackle. And obviously, if you have an inside pass rush, an inside disruptor at D tackle, he can cause havoc.
Greg Biggins is with us, 24/7 Sports National Recruiting Analyst. I thought about you earlier this year when Clemson plays a quarterback who I first heard about from you, DJ Uiagalelei. Am I saying that right?
Good, close enough, man.
All right, you're the first person I heard pronounce it, and you heard talk about him. But it's interesting to me. I thought about you as he's playing a game because I thought, I wonder if Biggins looks at these kids like, because you knew them when they were like 14, 15, 16-year-old kids. Now you're seeing them take the next step, and then some guys go to the NFL. Like, do you sit back as you watch games in major college football and go, yeah, I remember when that kid committed, or yeah, I could see that he was going to be a star, or man, that other kid really didn't pan out. Do you do some of that?
Oh, all the time. Every game. You know, again, I've been in this thing for 25-plus years, so now I'm seeing guys I covered, I'm seeing their kids. So, but yeah, every time you watch a college game, even an NFL game, they definitely bring back a lot of memories of their recruitment. And then, you know, guys that you build a relationship with, like DJ, great kid, great family, who you root for. Like, I don't root for teams. Honestly, I don't. I root for players that I got a chance to get to know and just really liked a lot by how they handled themselves and just, you know, just good, solid human beings. And yeah, you definitely hope they do well, but every time you watch a game, there's a ton of stories out there.
All right. Oregon State, they have a 2-4 record, but I saw a lot of improvement from Jonathan Smith's team. Like, I really do think if their quarterback had stayed healthy, they might be sitting at 4-2. Can you sell that to a recruit?
100%. And I think it's easier to sell it to you and me. And it kind of goes back to what we talked about, you know, with USC. You know, a lot of times, you know, I think a lot of times, you know, kids see wins and losses, whereas, you know, we see, you know, eyeball test, right? And I think using the eyeball test, you can see how much better Oregon State is. They play hard. They're tough. They run the football. Jamar Jefferson, again, watching him, I sat there and said, you know what? I should have had him ready to hire. And I said that in high school. I said, this is a guy who should be rated higher than we have him. He's really good. I don't know why we did it, but he's really good at football. And another guy, great kid, you want to root for. So, I think stylistically, Oregon State plays a fun brand of football. You know, I've always liked Jonathan Smith a lot. And, I think you can sell. You just hope kids are smart enough to understand, hey, look, we're 2-4, but did you watch the game? Like, did you see how we played? Did you see how competitive we were? Did you see that terrible spot we got against Washington? Like, stuff like that, right? Like, you can sell that, I think, you know, to a lot of people. Some kids may be harder, but I think for the most part, yeah, you can sell that for sure.
Craig Biggins, 24/7 Sports National Recruiting Analyst, is, when you look at the college football playoff rankings, you see programs that have got recruiting rankings that make sense. Is there somebody on that list when you look at maybe the top 10 or 12 or 15 teams where you go, man, they're coaching. They're not just recruiting, they're coaching. Because I think a lot of times we look at the top teams and we just say, wow, you could just rank them by their recruiting classes. But what do you see when you see the playoff ranking?
No, I think a lot of times, and again, we use this to kind of justify our rankings, not before, after the fact, but before the fact, there hasn't been a team in the playoffs, the Final Four, who has made it without having over 50% of the roster made up of 4- and 5-star guys. That's a stat. You can look it up. Final Four teams all have at least 50% of the roster. So you still need to be coached up, right? Now, I think you watch Bama and Ohio State. They look like they're really, really well coached to me. Now, I want to say I didn't watch the little presentation, the BCS presentation, but I want to say, like, is Iowa State, are they in there? There's like a team in there. It's kind of just like an outlier.
Yeah.
That wasn't like a traditional, was it them? I don't want to misspeak, but, and I think, how do they get in there, people would say. That proves it, right? Rankings don't matter. Look at, always use the
exception to the rule. Iowa State's at 6. Yeah.
And I guarantee you they do not have half of their roster made up of 4 and 5 stars, not even close. I think when you see that and you watch them play, you're like, okay, they obviously do a great job of evaluating. They do a great job of developing. They out-coach you. They out-scheme you. And that's what's great about football. It's not like basketball, right? These kids, basketball, you can go straight to the NBA. These guys are already ready to go. In football, you need 2-3 years to get these guys, to maximize their ceiling, their potential. I think Iowa State and their coach, man, he is so good. He is such a great coach. You watch him. And you just see, man, you don't see a bunch of dumb stuff, penalties, turnovers, unsportsmanlike. They're just really fundamental. And there is great linemen in the Midwest. Iowa usually cleans up on them, but Iowa State as well. You can get a lot of great linemen. If you have that, you can go from there. So, but I think for the most part, right, this is going to sound dumb, but the team with the best players is going to probably win the most games. As long as you have competent coaching, and I think Bama and Ohio State and Clemson, Georgia. I mean, those guys are all really, really good football coaches.
Greg Biggins, spitting truth as always. I want you to have a great Christmas with your family and take care of yourself. And thanks for giving us your time, my friend.
Always, man. You too. Have a great Christmas. I appreciate talking to you.
Greg Biggins, 24/7 Sports. I want you to leave it right here. So much to talk about. Anna has popped in. For those of you just catching up, we started the show today by talking to Ryan Abraham of USCFootball.com about the Ducks and the Trojans. You can find the podcast of that on SoundCloud, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, wherever you get a podcast. I should just say that. Wherever you get a podcast, you can find that podcast. Also, Jonathan Smith, Oregon State's coach, was with us in the 1 o'clock hour. If you want that podcast, find it. Also, Greg Biggins, 24/7 Sports National Recruiting Analyst. Great interview with him just a few minutes ago. Grab the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. Anna's popped into the studio. Anna, I thought about you earlier in the show because somebody paid $98,000 for the Mona Lisa experience. I'm using air quotes. The Mona Lisa experience. It was a VIP auction that the Louvre put out. You basically get some time with Mona Lisa. In exchange for winning this auction, you get to watch like the curators and the experts on art. I don't know what they do, but they probably take it out of the frame. Maybe they look at it under a microscope or a magnifying glass. Then they give it any appropriate care it needs. Are we doing this with all of our paintings and pictures around the house?
Yeah, annually.
Yeah.
Annually.
Once a year, we take down that photo of me on the wall. We inspect it, and then we put it back in the frame. No.
Maybe we could auction that off.
Somebody paid $98,000 to watch that.
Wow.
High bid.
$98,000.
Do you remember seeing Mona Lisa? You've seen it numerous times.
It's so small.
Exactly.
And you have to, like, you know, there's always a gaggle of people in front of it.
Yep.
So you can't, I can't even imagine what it's like now. But tourists.
That's what I said. I went there.
Like, we weren't tourists.
I was standing there, and they have the velvet rope up, and there's the guard in a suit standing next to it.
Yeah.
It's on the wall. It's really, like, not how I imagined it would be.
Yeah.
And then I imagined something. I don't know what I thought, but it wasn't that.
Right.
Like, just a regular white wall painted white with this underwhelmingly sized photograph on the wall.
Yeah.
You know?
And I don't know why it was even more comical to me the day that you and I got to go see this thing. It was the crowd that was in front of us was, they were all Japanese.
Yep.
And all, there's a very strict no flash rule.
Right.
When you're standing in front of the Mona Lisa, you're allowed to take photos of it. I don't even know if they allow photos anymore because people have auto flashes, and over time, all those flashes can, you know, affect the quality of the painting.
It can damage the painting. That's why I don't allow flash photography.
Yeah, right.
In this house.
Right.
No.
But there were flashes going off everywhere. Lots of Japanese being shouted.
Yeah.
It was, the whole scene was,
I made eye contact with the guard.
Yeah.
And I said, tourists.
It's so hypocritical.
You know what I mean? Can I get a croissant over here?
Oh my gosh.
Can I get, I never forget too, on that same little jaunt to Paris.
Oh,
we were only,
look at how you sound.
We were only in Paris for like 10 hours, maybe eight hours.
Yes.
Took the channel over, took the oldest daughter. She was with us.
Yes.
And we go over there. We decide we're going to see, like, what do we need to do today?
Paris for the day. We literally went to Paris for the day.
We went to the top of the Eiffel Tower really fast.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Did we pay extra to get...
Fast track that sucker.
Is
we
that
didn't have
what
time.
Was?
I didn't have time to wait in line with a bunch of Japanese tourists. I need to get to the top of this tower. And then we got up there. Check. Like, we checked it off the list. And then we were like, hustle out of here.
Uh-huh.
Like, if they had a fireman's pole at the top of the Eiffel Tower,
we would have taken it.
I would have been like straight down.
Yeah.
We climbed down the tower, then we gotta go to the Louvre, go see Mona Lisa.
Right.
I get over there.
I can't believe we fast tracked the Louvre.
Mona Lisa, awesome. Then we were like, we need to sit at a cafe and have lunch. Do you remember this?
Yes.
So we picked this place that looked like all the pictures in Paris. It was on the corner.
Yeah.
And we walked up, and this couple had this amazing tower of seafood on their table.
Yep.
It was like a tsunami had hit, and everything from the ocean had been poured out onto their table. Just a mound of shrimp and squid.
Snails.
Paris. It was just like so impressive.
Yeah.
I remember we pointed over there and I said, we'll have what they have.
Yeah.
Then they brought this thing out.
Uh-huh.
Almost none of it was edible.
It was three tiers of raw seafood.
It was almost inedible.
It was for three of us. One of us was a child.
And so basically you ate as much as you could eat.
Yeah. And I... You know, as we've discussed previously on the show, I am not shy when it comes to many foods, raw seafood. And
you'd be good in an eating contest.
Yeah. But this thing, it was like three tiers of raw seafood, and it was the kind of raw seafood that I don't even know how to describe this. There was so much of it that by the end of it, you just kind of felt like you were eating
the bottom
mounds of snot.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like salty. It was real
salty snot. Yeah.
And we didn't get through a lot of it.
It wasn't appetizing.
No.
It looked really good on the other person's table.
Yeah.
And then when they brought it to our table, I took a couple of bites and was like, no, I don't like the snails. I'm not touching that. I was kind of working my way around.
Yeah. Raw scallops, raw snails.
And then the bill came.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to be honest with you, this tower of seafood, I had not even inquired on what it would cost.
Yeah.
It was like $100 tower of seafood.
Blew our budget for the
day.
And
I was like, I just blew $100 on something I would never eat.
Big mistake. Big.
I should have just had a croissant.
Huge.
That's what I should have had.
Should. We did. But then we went over to the garden, de Luxembourg, or however you say it.
You know what we saw in the garden, Peter?
No, what's that?
Saw a bunch of people French kissing.
Really?
In France. It was pretty interesting. People were making out, and our teenager was probably like 6 or 8.
No, she
10?
Was. Yeah, she was about 10.
She was about 8.
Okay.
She's about 8.
8? Okay.
Yeah. She was 10.
Okay.
She says, what are they doing?
Yeah.
I don't know what you say as a parent when you see people like gnashing their teeth together, tongues are engorged.
Massive PDA.
And
I made the mistake of turning her, thinking I was really witty, saying, well, it's kind of funny that you ask because we're in France and they're actually French kissing.
And she said, that's disgusting.
And ran away from us at a full.
No,
full
she didn't
speed.
Run yet. Because she said, do you guys do that?
Oh, no.
And we both kind of got quiet. And then she goes, that's disgusting. And like any parent, like as their kids in horror realize, you know, like, oh no, that's happening in my world at some point.
That's my key memory of that day, is the massive family conflict we had outside the Louvre near the garden.
So you might say the Eiffel Tower was the highlight of the trip.
You might say. Because
the Mona Lisa was like,
You know the piece of artwork that is really more impressive than you think it might be when you go to see it in person? Like the opposite of the Mona Lisa is the Guernica by Picasso.
Hmm.
That thing, it's in Spain. And
showing off now, are you?
I can't remember now. Yeah. This was in college. But when you go, it's giant. It takes up a whole wall, and you don't realize it when you're looking at it like in an art, you know, history book or something like that. And then you go, and that's
I want to say Mona Lisa, not Da Vinci's best work. You know what I mean? That like I looked at that, and I'm like, really? Genius.
I love how you sound like George from Seinfeld.
You know what I mean?
Like that.
I look at that and it was just underwhelming for me. You know what would be the equivalent of that? It would be like some famous male porn star who is working out at your gym, and then he comes out of the shower and it's just, you're like, really? That's a porn star? That would be the equivalent.
I see the connection. That's an interesting turn.
You know what I mean? Peter, are you with me on that? Zach, anybody?
I was, John. You lost me at male porn star, I'm going to be honest.
Just underwhelming. You'd be like, that guy, really?
I have whiplash from that segue.
There you go. That's the equivalent of it. I just felt like Mona Lisa, like you hear of the Mona Lisa in third, fourth grade, right?
Right, yeah.
Or even younger sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you hear about it, and it's redone, and you see pictures, and everybody, you know what it looks like.
You know it.
And then you get up there, and it's like getting one of those, you know, it's like being on an airplane. You get the little mini pretzel pack.
But there's a lot of things in art that are like that at face value, they're not inherently impressive looking at them, but it's everything that they represent in terms of, like, the time frame in which they were created and the advances, you know, that they represent.
Right. All right. How about this? How about if it was not, forget the porn star metaphor. Although I think it was great. I think it probably worked for a lot of the audience.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.